This is the Sports Illustrated Boxing Podcast.
It's boxing.
A look inside boxing with Sports Illustrated's Chris Mannix. Interviews, analysis, and everything going on in boxing. And now a man who I wish was called the Boston Bleeder.
All doctors to the ER.
It's sort of like getting punched in the face.
Chris Mannix.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the SI Boxing Podcast. On this episode, we'll talk about the big light heavyweight unification fight this past weekend. The big 140-pound unification fight coming up this weekend. You got Daniel Jacobs set to make his debut at 168 pounds. Some news on Canelo Kovalev. Some news on the Hall of Fame. And the WBC continues to be just an awful, awful sanctioning body. Talk about that and much more. Let's bring in the great Dan Rayfield. Does a terrific job covering boxing over at ESPN and ESPN.com. What's up, Dan?
Hello, Chris. Good to be back on the pod.
Always appreciate your presence here, man. We got a lot to get to and a lot coming up in the next couple of weeks. So let's jump right into it here. Let's actually go back to this past weekend in Philadelphia. You and I were both ringside to watch Arthur Beterbiev just look terrific in his win over Alexander Vostik. Beterbiev is just a brutal, brutal puncher. I mean, he is just relentless when he chases you around the ring. I thought Vostik fought pretty well for most of the fight, but as tends to happen when you go up against opponents like Beterbiev, you got to be able to hold them off for 12 rounds, and Vostik could only do it for 9+. What did you make of what Beterbiev showed in his most significant fight to date?
I thought he did a great job. I mean, like you said, he is an absolute beast. He wears you down, and you know we knew that he was a tremendous puncher, and he was obviously a quality fighter. You don't go to the Olympics twice and have the kind of amateur career that he had and move as quickly in the pros as he had if you're not talented. I mean, if you go back and look at his early career record, he was taking on, like, solid, legit guys in, like, his third and fourth, fifth fight, knocking out guys like Tavoris Cloud. But Vostik was the best opponent he had fought, and the fact that he was able to continue to do that sort of stuff against him was very impressive. I thought he was winning that fight very closely when they got to the knockout round. There was a lot of people at ringside that had Vostik slightly ahead who had done a very good job of boxing and moving. And I understand you score boxing rounds round by round, but if you watch that fight, even if you thought that Vostik was doing the job in terms of the boxing, it was very obvious to anybody that was there that the guy that was doing the damage, the guy that was hitting harder, that was you know, taking the other guy and sort of breaking him down bit by bit, was what Beterbiev was doing to Vostik. So, you know, in the end, you know, it was like it reminded me a little bit of a fight from several years ago that I covered when Antonio Margarito fought Manny Pacquiao. I mean, I'm sorry, when Margarito fought Miguel Cotto in their first fight, sort of like the freight train with no brakes going downhill. You know, eventually he just ran the guy over. And that's pretty much what happened to Vostik. He put in a game effort, and by the time he got to the 10th round and got knocked down three times, you know, he was all done, and Beterbiev wins the fight, has his hand raised, and unifies two of the titles.
It was exactly what you were hoping for in a fight like that. You had two guys that are clearly elite in their weight class going back and forth, and I was one of the people, I think you did as well, like having Vostik up by a point in that going into that 10th.
I had Beterbiev up by a point when it was stopped.
Okay, I mean, yeah, either way, I had Vostik up by a point when it was stopped, but it was a close fight up until that point, and Vostik had a chance to win. Like, he was right there with an opportunity to win if he could just keep moving and keep sticking and moving, but that's what Beterbiev does. He just wears you down. He chases you around the ring. He cuts the ring off exceptionally well, and he beats up on you. I don't know that Vostik can... I don't know that he looks in the mirror and says, boy, I blew that one. He just... You know, he got beat by a better guy. And look, I think Vostik will come back. I think there's lots of light heavyweights you could match him up with that are on the top ranked side of the street. You got some good names there, some title holders, some lesser title holders, some former title holders in the case of Zerto Ramirez at 168. So he can certainly bounce back in a big fight. But Beterbiev, yeah, he showed he was scary. And I tell you, Dan, if he does target a unification fight sometime in the middle of next year against Dmitry Bivol, I don't know that it ends any differently. I mean, Bivol's even smaller than Vostik. He is a lesser puncher, I think, than Vostik. And I think he'll have some success early on, like Vostik did. But I think the same thing will happen. I think Beterbiev will get to Bivol and finish him in the same way.
Now, I'd like to see that fight for sure, because they're both, you know, probably the two best guys in the weight class at the moment, other than Kovalev, who has his own assignment coming up with Canelo. But I would like to see the fight, but I agree sort of with your assessment that Bivol matches up more style-wise to Vozic than he does to Beterbiev, and it could become a very similar kind of fight. I mean, Bivol is a little smaller. He's talked about how he could, if given the opportunity for the right fight, easily go down and make the 168-pound limit in the super middleweight division. And now you're taking on, if the fight were to happen, against Beterbiev, you know, who's a big-time, big-sized light heavyweight, you know, with tremendous punching power and almost like a relentless style, like just a continuous well of ability to just keep going forward and keep plowing ahead and keep throwing punches. You know, he didn't seem tired at all in that fight. But it's you know, if you want to make the big money and get the big names and get the opportunity to unify, you know, you're going to have to go through Beterbiev. Now, he's going to fight in the early part of next year. This was something that his handler spoke about after the fight, Bob Arum. They're very close already to a deal with his mandatory against a Chinese fighter. They might take that fight to China sometime in February. And after that, he would then have the opportunity to take, you know, a non-mandatory fight. And certainly Bivol, you know, who has the ability to pretty much fight where he wants because he's not tied down to any television broadcaster. They can go do their thing. It's just, to me, it's going to be, you know, what's going to be the money? That's the issue in making that fight. How are they going to work out a business deal?
Yeah, I mean, so how likely do you think that fight is to happen? Because you're right. I mean, Bivol has been fighting on DAZN, but he's not tied to DAZN. I don't think DAZN would be all that concerned about losing him since he's not exactly a draw in terms of, you know, subscription buyers, and he doesn't sell tickets really anywhere. At the same time, I mean, you're right. You do have to make a deal. I mean, do you think that those two sides can get together? I mean, we've seen you know, fights fall apart over less, and it would bother me, Dan, because, you know, that's a division that needs to have a unified champion. I mean, I think that division needs it. It needs its version of Usyk. It needs somebody to be undisputed there to get any kind of traction amongst like a mainstream-ish type of audience, because even after a fight like that against Beterbiev Vozic, I mean, Beterbiev still isn't a household name. He's going to need to beat Bivol and maybe unify against either Kovalev or somebody else down the line to really gain traction amongst a different set of fans.
I mean, it's definitely a makeable fight. It's going to come down to what is the Bivol camp going to want financially. They've had conversations you know, with Top Rank. And remember, when he was, before he did the fight against Lennon Castillo, you know, they had taken an offer from PBC for multi-fights. They had had a conversation with Top Rank, which was interested but didn't have any room on their schedule or, frankly, in their budget for the remainder of this year. But that will change, obviously, once the new year kicks around and the schedule opens up and the financial elements become a little more easy to deal with. But they also are way far apart. So Beterbiev and Vozic each made $1.5 million for the unification fight when they met each other. And the Bivol camp, for, you know, any old fight, has been seeking, you know, seven figures more than that, from what I am told. So, you know, they're going to all have to get in the same, you know, hemisphere, at least on the money, or Bivol's going to just be kind of left out in the cold. He's an excellent fighter. I enjoy watching him. He may not be the most exciting guy, but he does a really good job against everybody they put him in with. But the main thing is, you know, he doesn't sell tickets. He doesn't draw a big crowd. You know, he's been a champion now for a while. He just fought on Usyk's undercard. So, you know, their financial expectations may be a little bit out of whack for what's legitimately available. I look at it like this. If Bivol were to fight for the kind of money that Beterbiev and Vozic fought for, it's probably a doable fight. If he's going to ask, instead of $1.5 million, he's going to ask for two or two and a half or three, you know, then, you know, thank you, but no thank you. You can go back and fight the Lennon Castillos of the world and, you know, not be in a big-time fight.
Yeah, and what world is he worth that type of money? I mean, like, I know that the pay scale is kind of out of whack these days and has been for a little while, but $1.5 million sounds about right.
Eddie and DAZN have thrown around a huge amount of money, and I think some guys have gotten a little spoiled, to be quite frank.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. But if I'm DAZN and I'm looking at kind of the guys that can sort of fall by the wayside, I mean, I know that Tevin Farmer's kind of on that list, I believe, although I think he will get another fight against Jojo Diaz at some point in the next few months. But you know, Bivol with nobody really for him to fight, like, that's a guy that you could say, all right, well, you know, if you don't want to take whatever money we're offering that we can fit in our budget, go somewhere else.
If he wants to fight in the super middleweight division, there would be quality opportunities for him over on the PBC side. There certainly would be opportunities with DAZN, given their association with guys like Callum Smith. So, you know, him and his team have to decide, A, where does he want to fight? What kind of fights does he want? What's their expectations financially? It's not that complicated, to be quite honest. I mean, if he wants to be in the light heavyweight picture, he should be fighting on ESPN. If he wants to be in the super middleweight picture, then he may have better alternatives.
Let me ask you this. This is something we were kind of kicking around on press row there for a minute. Let's say Beterbiev fights Bivol and beats him and wins three pieces of that title. And let's say Canelo beats Kovalev. Do you think in any world Canelo would take on Bivol for the undisputed light heavyweight championship?
I have a hard time seeing it, but you know, one thing about Canelo is he's shown a willingness to fight the best guys, you know, over the last number of years. Not every single fight is against a superstar opponent, but he's fought a lot of quality guys. He's actually at times, through the sheer will, forced his own handlers to make certain fights that they were not comfortable with, but he wanted them. You know, his people did not want any part of the Austin Trout fight. He made that fight happen. They didn't want any part of the Arislandi Lara fight. They made that happen. They really didn't want the Triple G first fight. He made that happen sooner than Golden Boy and Oscar De La Hoya would have liked to make that fight. So he has shown that he is willing to do that. I think there might have been a little bit of that involved in this Kovalev fight, although I think that the handlers were a little more open to that, maybe you know, looking at that, the way Kovalev has looked in recent fights, his age and the perception of, you know, that he's vulnerable. But nonetheless, Canelo has shown that he would fight top guys. So it wouldn't totally shock me if he wanted to go and do a Beterbiev fight should he beat Kovalev. But I think there's bigger fights and bigger money for him to stay, either to go back to middleweight or perhaps to fight in the super middleweight division, because you know, Beterbiev would be an exciting fight and an interesting fight for sure. It's not a crossover mainstream kind of fight, at least not yet, and that's not Canelo's fault. That's because Beterbiev, despite the great victory that he had against Vodic, is not a household name, and far from it. Just he's a top quality fighter, but he doesn't have you know, any sort of you know, X factor with the public. Let's say he's just not known. It doesn't mean he's not good. It doesn't mean he's not worthy of that kind of fight. But if you're Canelo, you know, it's still business, and there's lots of other fights out there for him. And, you know, you tell me, DAZN has him under contract for, what, nine more fights, and he's going to fight this fight with Kovalev, and then do you think they're going to want him to fight Beterbiev, which would be a fun fight, but they would rather have a third Golovkin fight? They would probably even rather have a Callum Smith fight. So, you know, the sides are going to have to figure out what they want to do.
All right, let's talk about the fight coming up this weekend. Regis Prograis is going to put his piece of the 140-pound title on the line over in the UK against hometown favorite Josh Taylor. This is a fight I'm really excited about, Dan, because I think it's a coin flip type of fight. Two guys that are not necessarily different in style, but they do fight differently. Taylor's got a size advantage in terms of height. Prograis is just a kind of a hammer out there in the ring. You know, these two guys, I don't think they like each other very much, which adds another element to it. I mean, how do you see this fight playing out?
I love this fight. I mean, I don't necessarily see there being, like, any deep bitterness between the two. I mean, they may be scrapping with each other a little bit, and they'll build up just because guys get on edge as they get closer to the fight. But to my way of looking at it, they've been gentlemen, not in a lot of trash talk, but they're both extremely confident. They're both undefeated. They both have titles. They both have good experience. You know, it's another fight in a long line of fights we've seen this year where you've seen top guys fight each other. It's yet another unification fight, which is something that is good for the sport, in my opinion. You know, I'm glad that Prograis and his team were able to work out their differences with the folks that run the World Boxing Super Series. At one point, he had dropped out and sued them. They were able to overcome those difficulties. He came back into the tournament, and now here we are. It's, you know, on the, you know, just a couple of days before the fight. And I think most people expect a good, exciting, competitive fight. And the winner is certainly going to come out of that with a higher level of notoriety. They're going to have two titles, going to have that undefeated record, and set themselves up for some certainly much bigger business, even beyond what they're going to do in this fight against each other. It's everything. If you're a boxing fan, it's exactly what you want. Two of the best guys, big stakes. style matchup that probably will be appealing when they actually, you know, hear the bell and they go at it with each other. It's a great fight. I mean, I hope it works out that way. I mean, I'm pumped up for it. I can say that.
Yeah, you know, Progre has come out and said, like, this is one versus two. These are the top two guys, the 140-pound division. Now, I'm sure Jose Ramirez has something to say about that, but these are certainly two elite-level guys at that weight class. And I'm not sure how it plays out. I mean, I've seen the way Progre's fought and as he's kind of evolved as a fighter in his last couple of fights. He'll try to get on the inside. He'll try to bang it out. His defense has certainly gotten a little bit better in recent fights, but I'm not sure that's going to be a big factor in a fight like this. I think this could be, aesthetically, Dan, a really good fight because of those styles. And maybe it's just because I think Progre always makes good fights. He's just that kind of entertaining.
Kind of be a little better Bev Vodzik-ish in the sense that, you know, it's a very even matchup. They're both highly regarded guys. They don't fight in the exact same style, but styles that probably will lend itself to a good fight. And, you know, when the tournament started, they were both the number one. Regis was number one, and Taylor was the number two seed. And so the final has played out the way that it was supposed to based on the seeding. So it's one versus two, at least in terms of the tournament. You know, Jose Ramirez has, in my opinion, proven himself professionally against better opposition at this point than Progre has. Josh Taylor has a good resume also. So to me, no knock on Regis, but Ramirez has done more. And he also was the first, you know, he's the one that also was able to unify against Maurice Hooker. So, you know, ideally, and I think it's possible, the winner of the fight on Saturday at some point next year against Ramirez is a distinct possibility, in my opinion.
Yeah, look, I think that the winner of this fight, the stakes kind of couldn't be any higher in terms of what the reward is on the other end. If you just look at it, I know politics often get involved and money gets involved, but if you look at it objectively, the winner of this fight will have two titles. You go over to fight Jose Ramirez in the U.S. somewhere, that's a significant fight, whether it's on ESPN or on pay-per-view, whatever. And then the winner of that fight, you can make a case that you are a strong candidate to face Terrence Crawford at some point in 2020. Like, you could go from Ramirez to Crawford right away.
There is a distinct possibility that if Regis comes out of this tournament with both of those titles, that Ramirez, his game plan is sort of already set at the moment. Their plan is to have the mandatory against Postal, who's a former title holder, who Josh Taylor has a win over, to do that fight probably in February. After that, he has a second mandatory due against Jack Catterall, another very solid contender, which is not a bad fight at all. And that would probably be, you know, the spring/summer fight for Ramirez. In the meantime, Progre would come back to America, most likely defend the unified titles that he will potentially have won against Josh Taylor, perhaps even a second time, staying on the same schedule as Ramirez. And then sometime around this time next year, we will see Ramirez and Progre meet for the undisputed title in that weight class. And then obviously, the guy who wins that fight, and even the loser of that fight, very likely would go up to 147 pounds. And either one of them who comes out of that would be sitting there pretty for an opportunity, and what would probably be a deserved opportunity to take on Terrence Crawford, who, you know, is going to be probably still reigning as one of the title holders in the welterweight division. So that's not something that's written in stone, but that's sort of like the rough idea. And certainly if Josh Taylor wants in on that sort of scenario, he probably could have it also.
Yeah, the former undisputed 140 versus the current undisputed 140, that's a pretty appealing matchup for a lot of reasons. Let me ask you this, as we wind down the second season of the World Boxing Super Series, you know, what are your takeaways from? I know this sort of incarnation with the bantamweights and the 140-pounders, a little more troubled than the first time around. The financial issues were obviously well chronicled, but you can't argue with the fact that, you know, in the first run of it, Usyk came out of it a bigger star because of it. I think Progre or Taylor is going to be a bigger star. In a way, if he beats Donaire, is going to be a bigger star. It's had kind of its desired effect, at least if your desired effect is, you know, a better name recognition at this point. I mean, what have been your takeaways from it?
No, I agree. They in the first two seasons, they were able to put together excellent fields in weight classes where there were fighters that maybe weren't household names, who were very talented, who had titles, but did not have big profiles. Prior to the I guess, the birth of DAZN, if you will, it was a disaster because their broadcast situation in the United States was ridiculously terrible. They've run their business poorly, in my opinion. They had a lot of problems. They had a lot of potential lawsuits and guys who didn't get paid on time. And now that's one of the worst things you can do in boxing as a promoter, is to have guys get in the ring and punch each other for, you know, however long the fight goes and not pay them on time. That's unforgivable, whether it was bonus money or purse money. They had a lot of issues with that. They lost one of their sponsors that was putting up a lot of money. So the way it was run internally, there was a lot of issues. But you can't argue with what they did to get the top guys to go into the tournament. Now, I think in the future, because of all these kinds of problems, they may have trouble attracting some of the top guys. I've heard from numerous promoters and managers, and frankly some fighters, who were like, I'm not going to ever go into that. It's too much of a pain in the neck. But when it's done properly, and the fights actually are taking place, you know, they've done a good job with it. Now, I did think in this second season, having yet another cruiserweight tournament, which was the third tournament they did this year. First year, they just did the two tournaments at super middleweight and at cruiserweight. In the second season, as you mentioned, they're doing bantamweights, junior welterweights, but they also did yet another edition of cruiserweights. That was entirely unnecessary. Seems like a complete waste of money and time, particularly because the whole concept of the first season was to crown the undisputed champion, which they did with Usyk, and then he was still defending against Tony Bellew when they were putting together the second season. Now, obviously, because he ended up vacating at various times his other belts and decided to move up in weight, those belts became vacant, and some of them had become available and were put into the tournament. But I just thought the second season cruiserweights were completely unnecessary. If they can just stick to a more refined, pick two weight classes, do it the way you did the first season, pay your guys on time, make sure your money is in order, you know, they can do a very solid job. You know, but they didn't do, in my opinion, they didn't do a very good job promoting the fights in the United States. The few events that they had here, you know, they had bad dates for some of them. They had poor locations for some of them. They didn't do a great job promoting them. They didn't sell a lot of tickets. Obviously, they were, you know, they still had DAZN as their broadcaster, but, you know, DAZN still was not mainstream, let's say. I mean, they're getting there, it seems, but at that time when this second season was going on, you know, people still would ask me, like, how do I watch the fight? Where do I find DAZN? Like, they just didn't know. So they had a lot of issues. So there's been a lot of good things about it, but there's been a lot of things that if they're going to continue on, they really need to work out.
Yeah, I'm with you. And you have to be selective with your weight classes. I completely agree that going cruiserweight again was a mistake. So if they can get it together, I do think as much a mistake as anything was not finding a way to do both the Inoue Donaire and Prograis Taylor on the same card in the United States. Now, I know money talks in situations like this, and certainly there's a gate that could be done doing Inoue over in Asia and Josh Taylor in Japan and splitting up the shows. I get all that, but you do Inoue Donaire as the co-main to Prograis Taylor as the main, or even if you want to reverse it, I don't really care. That's a terrific event, and that's a way to get a ton of eyeballs. I know that DAZN was interested in doing that, but they couldn't make it work with the Boxing Super Series. But that, to me, Dan, feels like a way that you could have injected that Super Series into the mainstream and given it maybe some momentum. Maybe you would have had the ability to announce another weight class. Or, you know, coming up in our next, you know, Super Series, we'll do 154, just throwing that out there as an example. Instead, you've kind of got these two events which are reasonably big and will be watched by the hardcore boxing fans, but it won't get anywhere near the mainstream coverage that having it all on one night would be.
Well, I mean, DAZN obviously wanted to have some of these events in the United States. So now, again, the final matchups are perfectly good. Obviously, Taylor and Prograis that we've been talking about, it's a tremendous matchup. But it's going to be a Saturday, on a college football Saturday, at, you know, the main event probably goes around 5 p.m. Eastern time, not the most conducive for a top audience, when, you know, Inoue is going to be a much heavier favorite in his fight against Donaire, but Donaire has a very big name and, you know, certainly earned his way into the final. That fight, because it's taking place in Japan, my understanding is that fight will take place most likely in the morning hours American time because of the, you know, it's about a 12-hour difference between here and Japan. So that doesn't really do anything for anybody. Now, the hardcore people like, you know, me and you, you know, I'll be up watching that fight whenever that fight is on. But that's where we're in the vast minority. So Inoue against Donaire is not even going to probably register in this country. Taylor and Prograis slightly more, obviously. But, you know, I still don't think that because of the timing for the United States market, it's going to do anything. And, you know, people can say, well, you know, you're just a stuck-up American. Well, no, I'm not a stuck-up American. I also live in the real world and know this is where the most eyeballs are for those events and where the most money would be, you know, for those events. DAZN was willing to pay a lot more to have those in this time zone. It didn't work out that way. And so, you know, there are still tremendous fights that will happen, but they will be, you know, not nearly as well covered or seen as they should have been.
Yeah, and it is a good card, especially in the UK, because it's backstopped, at least in terms of how they're going to draw, by Derek Chisora against David Price, which is two guys that are pretty popular over in the UK. Chisora keeps going from one big fight to the next. He wins some, he loses some. David Price on like his third attempt at you know, redemption, if you will.
Well, you know, Price also took the fight on shortish notice because there was a change in that situation. But, you know, when Eddie Hearn was looking for an opponent to fight Chisora when the original fight fell apart, you know, for his audience there, for the British pay-per-view, for the arena in London, obviously making Chisora Price made a lot of sense. And, you know, that should be a fun fight. I don't think it's the highest stakes fight of all time, but if you like heavyweights, that should be a good scrap, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, I'm curious because, look, the winner takes a step forward, right? And, you know, I think Chisora is justifiably the favorite in a fight like this, but Price can crack, and he certainly has shown the ability to stop guys before. But the winner of that fight, let's see him maybe against Joseph Parker. Maybe we see them against Usyk. It's at least relevant, you know? It's a relevant heavyweight fight that I think we need to see more of out there.
Now, if Parker had not gotten ill and was able to stay in the fight and fight with Chisora, you know, it takes on maybe a little bit more of significance. But Chisora goes from being the underdog to being the favorite. So for him, it's probably a good thing.
Sometime in December, Dan, I think December 20th is the working date, we're going to see Daniel Jacobs back in the ring. He's going to move to 168 pounds. Right now, the plan is to have Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. be his opponent as he moves up to 168. Jacobs coming off the loss to Canelo. It really was only a matter of time before he moved to super middleweight. He was always a very big middleweight who it took a lot out of him to get down to 160 pounds. Now he moves up. He puts himself into an interesting mix of fighters up there. What do you make of Jacobs at 168 pounds and what kind of threat he can be?
I think it's a welcome addition to a weight class, no doubt about it. You know, he has had trouble making 160. Once you lose to Canelo, you've lost your title. I'm not sure what else there was for him to do in that weight division. There was no obvious fight for him, no big, huge money fight for him. You know, he's never said, I want to stay at middleweight for the rest of my career. I think even years ago, the thought was at some point he was going to move up to the next weight division. And, you know, when you lose that fight to Canelo and you have struggled to make weight, it's like what has happened, you know, 1,000 times before and will happen 1,000 times again. Guys lose in a weight class where they've done very well. And when that happens, you know, it's time to see what you can do in the next weight class above. So he moves up to 168, presumably put himself into the mix. Given the fact that he's on DAZN, there will be opportunities, I would think, in that weight class to make some solid world title fights because of the fact that, again, Billy Joe Saunders is fighting on DAZN. He has one of the belts. Callum Smith is fighting on DAZN. He has one of the belts. So those would be presumably his targets. The other two guys with belts, which are Caleb Plant and David Benavidez, they fight on with PBC, and obviously Danny is signed to DAZN. So those are going to be the types of fights we're going to probably see him in if he gets a title shot against a Saunders or a Smith. But in terms of his debut in the weight class, if they're finally able to close the deal with Chavez Jr., which has been on the table, I wrote about it like 2 months ago probably, and for whatever reason it's still not signed yet, and there's still a deal that's not 100% done on either side as far as I understand it, but I suspect it will get done. But I know there's always nervousness when you're dealing with Chavez because nobody knows if he's actually going to show up, and if he does show up, is he going to be on weight? So they have to address those sorts of situations, make sure they have a quality backup in place in case Chavez flakes out and can't be involved in the fight. But in terms of Danny Jacobs, he's been in camp. He's getting ready for the fight. Most likely, like you said, December 20th. It was supposed to be December 13th. Before that, it was supposed to be in October. I assume that we will see Danny in the ring before the end of this year and fighting in his new weight class.
Yeah, I think that you know, there's certainly concern about Chavez. I think that one thing we're going to see, and I wrote about this earlier in the week, that's a likelihood is that we'll see Gabe Rosado on the undercard and is kind of on standby in case Chavez comes in like 174 and doesn't show up, as you kind of said. I mean, he's
nothing against Gabe, who's given, you know, a lot of effort and a lot of blood and all that over these years. And with Chavez, that's a whole different story. But I don't know. I have a hard time getting excited about seeing Danny Jacobs against Chavez Jr. because Chavez Jr. doesn't try in fights anymore. He's a name-only fighter. Nobody cares about Chavez. Even the Mexican fans don't like him anymore because he didn't show up against Canelo. You know, I'm not knocking Chavez Jr. because he lost the fight. Guys lose. That's no problem. No sweat. But when you get in the ring and you don't give even a modicum of effort, it's when people get disgusted. When you spend your entire camp just trying to make that weight to cash your check and you don't try, you know, why should you get another chance in this caliber of a fight? So, you know, I'm not sure what the obsession is with Jacobs fighting against Chavez. I don't really care about that fight. And again, Rosado, exciting fighter, been in a lot of good fights, but, you know, let's be honest, it's a different level of fighter between Jacobs and Rosado. Would you give Rosado any chance to beat Danny Jacobs? No offense to Gabe. Once again, I like Gabe. No chance in that fight. So, you know, I just don't get the obsession with the Chavez fight. And, you know, if the best they can do as a backup is Rosado, you know, I have a hard time getting pumped up for it.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I mean, I like Gabe Rosado too. It's just, and I like what he did in the last fight against Maciek Selecki, where he knocked him down late in that fight, and he made it exciting towards the end. But against Danny Jacobs at 168, I just don't give him much of a chance. Let me ask you this though: Does Chavez working with Freddie Roach again do anything for you? Does that make you any more intrigued with this fight?
No, I mean Chavez Jr. could work with Freddie, Teddy Atlas, Eddie Futch. You know, Buddy McGirt, you know, Emmanuel Stewart, you pick the great trainers, you know. You want to put him in, any of those guys in this corner. Chavez is who he is. He's not at this age, in this stage of his career, going to suddenly find dedication. He's not going to find, you know, suddenly the devotion to come in and really give a top-notch effort. I mean, Freddie Roach was his trainer when he fought Sergio Martinez in their fight several years ago. And I remember speaking with Freddie after that fight, and all he did was complain about the fact that Chavez wouldn't show up at the gym, maybe showed up at the gym barely a few days before that fight. He would go to his apartment that they had for him. They would move the couch out of the way and set up like an area in the living room to simulate a ring. I mean, it was a joke. I mean, if you watched the 24/7 that HBO did, you saw Chavez running around in this pink underwear you know, eating cereal. So that was when Freddie was the trainer. So I hope that Freddie's being well paid because, you know, the last time he worked with Chavez Jr., it didn't really go so well. And I don't weigh that at the feet of Freddie. You can't make the guy come to the gym. You know, so if Freddie's guy is not there and not dedicated, you know, that's on the fighter, not on Freddie.
Yeah, I'm with you there. All right, let me run through a few things with you here to finish up. We have the referee and the judges set for Canelo versus Kovalev. The Nevada State Athletic Commission, Bob Bennett, has chosen Russell Mora to be the referee in that fight. They're also going to have Julie Letterman, Dave Moretti, and Don Trella as the judges for the Alvarez-Kovalev fight. Do any of those names stand out to you? Any red flags there in your mind?
I was a little surprised with some of the selections, to be honest with you. You know, Russell Mora has been a referee in Nevada for a long time, has never really caught the top assignments. Most people haven't considered him to be the best referee of the group in Nevada, but he has been a good referee, not perfect, obviously, like nobody is, obviously. But, you know, giving him an opportunity to fight like this, you know, I kind of like it. I mean, he's paid his dues. You know, it's probably time for him to get this kind of assignment. There's a few things back, you know, years ago that maybe there were some issues with, but I think he's grown as a ref. So even though that was slightly surprising, you know, I'm okay with that. I think that's solid. Russell, I hope, will do a very good job in that fight. Dave Moretti is a staple of the Las Vegas biggest fights. He's been one of the best judges for decades. He has worked in numerous major fights. This is going to be his ninth Canelo Alvarez fight. He has worked five of his last – it'll be his fifth in his last six bouts. The only one he didn't work was the fight against Rocky Fielding because that took place in New York, and Moretti does most of his fights in Las Vegas. He's not a judge that is licensed by the New York State Athletic Commission. So he's doing Canelo fights in, you know, constantly. So he's also one of the best out there. So to me, every big fight that ends up in Las Vegas, it doesn't surprise me when Dave Moretti is assigned to the fight. Julia Letterman, who's a New York judge, and Nevada has done a good job in recent years since Bennett has been running the show on the commission, where they will bring in out-of-state judges on a regular basis as well as out-of-country judges to work some of the bigger fights. And Julie's been a tremendous judge also. Now, there's been a few questionable calls over the years, but what judge hasn't had those? She comes from the great background. Her father is the late, great Harold Letterman. She knows her stuff. I've known Julie for many, many years. You know, she is as devoted to boxing, and it takes it as serious as anybody in terms of the judges I've ever met. doesn't shock me at all that you would get this assignment. Now, Don Trell is from Connecticut. Don's a great guy. I have known Don for many years, so I'll say that right up front. And Don has worked a lot of big fights and done a great job. However, he's the one of the guys that scored the first fight between Canelo and Triple G, 114-114. The only reason why he has not had a reputation destroyed because of that score is because the other judge on that fight, Adelaide Bird, actually gave it to Canelo. So if Adelaide Bird's not there and he gives that fight a draw, it's Don Trell that we're all complaining about. He kind of got to hide with that terrible scorecard. Again, I'm not knocking Don as a judge in general, but it just struck me as sort of surprising that they would assign him to another Canelo fight given what happened not that long ago. So for the sake of having zero element of controversy, you can't tell me there's not another quality judge in their pool, of which there's probably got to be about 20 different judges they could pick from, that you could have selected to work this fight, you know, just for the appearance sake, because that was an atrocious card. Let's be honest. So, again, I like Don, and Don does a great job, but I just would not be assigning him to Canelo Alvarez fights. So if there's going to be something to look at leading into the fight, judging-wise, you know, it might be the Trella scorecard as it goes. I hope that whoever wins, we get a knockout, and I don't have to deal with Nevada judges when the bell rings at the end of the fight.
All right, let me run through one other thing with you. The Hall of Fame ballots are out. You wrote about your decisions, and I agree with a lot of them. And one thing you wrote a lot on towards the end of your column on it was the decision to vote for Shane Mosley. And Shane Mosley, on paper, certainly one of the great fighters of all time, multiple weight class champion, had some significant wins in his career, just a great overall fighter. But he was caught up in that Balco scandal associated with Victor Conti, said he unknowingly used, what was it, the cream in the clear in before a fight. And that taints him to a degree. And it's begged the question to me, Dan, that, you know, should we as Hall of Fame voters do what baseball voters have done? If somebody has admitted to using performance-enhancing drugs like the Barry Bonds and the Roger Clemens and others in baseball that are either admitted or been associated with, should they be kept out of the Hall of Fame? You decided to vote for Shane Mosley. Just explain for a minute your kind of position on that.
Well, first of all, I did not do it lightly at all. I agonized. I thought a lot about it. I mean, I'm not joking when I say, like, I was on a recent flight coming or going to one of the fights I was covering, and I had taken a picture of the ballot, you know, with my phone, and I was like on this airplane trip, and I was like staring at the ballot, like trying to figure out what to do, and really thinking hard about it. I covered Shane Mosley's, you know, most of his big fights. The fight that you mentioned where he had used the clear and the cream, supposedly unknowingly, was prior to the rematch he had in 2003 against Oscar De La Hoya for the junior middleweight world title. He claims that that was the only time he had ever used performance-enhancing drugs. The rest of his career has never really had any notion or rumor or speculation or anything that he had used. Again, it's not a perfect scenario, and as I wrote in the column, some votes are not easy. And there was other candidates that I wanted to vote for, and there were some, you know, because of the way that the Hall of Fame redid the way that the ballots were constructed this year because of the eligibility rules that were changed, etc., with not getting into the minutia, there were literally like 15 candidates I would have liked to vote for. You can only vote for five, and three get elected, and anybody else who might achieve 80% or better of the vote. I just felt like Shane Mosley, as a lightweight, might be one of the best two or three in the history of boxing. No reason to believe that he used steroids at that time back in the late 90s. You know, I don't know for sure, but it really only came up in 2003 and never again after that. And, you know, he did have it on a good title reign as a lightweight. He did beat De La Hoya twice. I thought he lost the second fight, but he got the win. Fought a lot of big fights. You know, has two losses to Winky Wright, who's in the Hall of Fame. Two losses to Vernon Forrest, who was his rival from the amateurs, and he could just never get over the hump against him. You know, and had you know, fought a lot of big names, maybe some that he lost to later in his career. But at his best, most people had Shane Mosley pound for pound number one, you know, in the years following the first victory against Oscar De La Hoya. So talent-wise, and his amateur career was stellar. You know, to me, he was a Hall of Famer. The drug usage bothered me. But I also understand and believe that there's plenty of guys that have used that we don't know about who are already in the Hall of Fame, and undoubtedly there's going to be guys who are going to be voted in that we don't know about who also use. So the fact that we know about him, I just made the decision that, you know what, it's drug use, unfortunately, is part of not just boxing, but all of professional sports. If I was voting in the Baseball of Fame, I ultimately probably would vote for guys like Clemens and Bonds just based on what they had done even before. It was very obvious that maybe they were using. I've read any number of columns and pieces from baseball writers, you know, giving their points of view on it. I respect anybody that didn't want to vote for Shane Mosley for that reason. That's their prerogative, but it's my prerogative to vote for him. And it's going to come up in the future when other fighters who have had positive tests are going to become eligible for the Hall of Fame. James Toney is eligible for the Hall of Fame ballot next year. Canelo Alvarez has had a positive drug test. He's going to be eligible someday for the Hall of Fame. And there are others. Now, James Toney is a guy that I may not vote for because he was busted twice for steroids. You know, you do it once, I think you can be forgiven and get a second chance. You do it twice, I'm not so sure. So, you know, the James Toney thing may not be too much of a problem. But there will be some, and there still are people that hold against Canelo, you know, to this day, it's even though it has only been like a year, who constantly harp on the clenbuterol test, which has been proven, by the way, that there have been athletes in Mexico who have eaten tainted meat because of the way that they cultivate their food and their cattle, that it is not an uncommon occurrence. Now, maybe he wasn't the smartest to do it the way he did it, but it happened, and, you know, he moved on. And he did, you know, have the six-month suspension, which didn't really do a whole lot, but nonetheless, you know, are you going to hold that against Canelo for the rest of his career? Or are you going to hold that one instance against Mosley and not allow him into the Hall of Fame when every other element of his career seems to be worthy of being a Hall of Famer? You know, I made the decision to vote for him, and, you know, I'll live with it.
Dan, appreciate it, man. Always great to talk to you, and I will see you next week in Las Vegas. Canelo Covalent, looking forward to it, man.
I look forward to it also. I look forward to the fight. Look forward to seeing you.